Warden's Watch podcast is now on Patreon, combining the Thin Green Line podcast and the Warden's Watch podcast on Patreon to bring member-exclusive extra content, both video, audio, and with product deals as well. Become a member to support our podcast and get something extra. Search Warden's Watch podcast on Patreon.
Welcome back to another episode of the Thin Green Line podcast. Today, we are very happy and honored to have a good friend of mine. We've run around together for about a decade, and his name is Jared Ogden. He comes from a family background of military service, patriotism to this country. He's a dual warfare qualified naval officer and a SEAL Team 1 veteran that spent 8 years in the Navy and was deployed 4 times in the Middle East during the peak conflict era of the global war on terror. He's been awarded the Bronze Star with Valor, the Combat Action Ribbon, and multiple joint awards. He's a wildlife conservationist near and dear to all of us on the Thin Green Line. He's a staunch 2A supporter, an entrepreneur, and CEO and founder of Triant Systems, a reactive target company geared toward the training needs of military, domestic first responders, and civilians worldwide. And we're going to talk about a lot of stuff. And Jared, it is so cool to have you on the show. How are you doing today, my brother?
Man, I'll tell you, has it been 10 years?
It has been 10 years since we met.
Time just flies.
I know, man. Yeah. I know. How you doing?
Wow. Today? Okay. I'm doing good. How are you?
We're great. I know you're in Missouri at our factory headquarters, correct? Wayne's out in New Hampshire. Yep. Yeah. And I'm down from Montana back on the West Coast in California. So we're kind of triangulating the man of the country today.
Yeah, we've got all the time covered.
And brother, I got to just let our listeners know kind of how we met, because it kind of puts some context on who you are outside of just being, you know, a veteran warrior and protecting our country for all the right reasons. We met through our friend Blake Bechtel way back in the day, going back about a decade. And he kind of brought us together for our first hunt together. It was that elk hunt on horseback in the Bob Marshall Wilderness area. I think our first elk hunt collectively. And it was an absolute blast. We got to know each other. We got to break bread. We got to suffer in the weather and the climbs and the horse hunts and all of that. And that's when I really, really resonated with you as a conservationist, a fellow Thin Green Liner. Mm-hmm. So that was absolutely amazing.
Yeah, that was a great hunt. To this day, I want to repeat that trip at some point. If we get back out to the Bob Marshall wilderness and do another elk hunt, that would be stellar.
Yeah, we definitely have to make it happen. And the other thing I got to let our listeners know is it was your crazy influence that got me to jump out of a perfectly good airplane and parachute for the first time. And Jared was literally in the same plane when I jumped out to have my very first skydive. And he gave me that fly with the birds, brother. I went, it's all or nothing.
So he pushed you.
Figuratively, actually did, and it was an amazing experience. And we jumped a couple times since. So I got to thank you for overcoming that barrier in my special operation.
Well, here's what I'll say about that whole experience: you never forget your first time.
Nope. No, that was an e-ticket ride of all the crazy stuff we've done collectively, right? So that was another great memory we shared together, and I'm grateful for it.
Yeah.
But start us off, man, with why you went into the military, what your family service history was. And I know 9/11 had a huge influence on where you were, what you were doing, and just your whole background, because it really needs to be shared.
Well, I'd say from a very young age, before I can remember, I wanted to serve in the military. And there's no pivotal moment or experience or conversation that I can, you know, track that to. It's just something that I've always wanted to do. My dad, he was a ranger in Vietnam. He was an Arvin Airborne Division platoon commander or platoon leader, and the military. We talked about it, but it was not ever anything that my parents or family pushed for. It was not encouraged, but it also wasn't not encouraged. If that makes sense. At the end of the day, my parents, they raised 4 great kids, and they wanted for us to be productive citizens. And, you know, I think that the key to being successful in life is, you know, you got to do something that you're interested in. You've got to do something that you're good at. And the more you can align your interest with something that you're good at, you know, success typically will follow that. So military, it wasn't encouraged. It wasn't discouraged. And I set my sights on the Naval Academy. And I wanted to be a Navy SEAL from a very young age. Probably didn't even know what all that entailed. But, you know, maybe I was the product of, like, you know, some good marketing, or maybe that Charlie.
A good with the right movie.
Yeah. Yeah. So that, you know, when I was in, I remember being in middle school and I wanted to be a SEAL, but the closest thing that I knew to a SEAL was my cousin, who was a midshipman at the Naval Academy, who wanted to be a SEAL. So I didn't even know any SEALs at that point, but I saw my cousin, 7 years older, you know, going down this track. And I said, well, that's how you do it. Right. So in middle school, I said, I'm going to go to the Naval Academy. So I was intentional in selecting a magnet math science public high school that was not my normal high school. It was a little bit further away. But I knew that to go to the Naval Academy, you've got to have, you know, a strong math, science, engineering. They call it STEM now. You've got to have that strong background. So I went to this magnet program and, you know, took the right classes, the AP maths and sciences and whatnot. And in my decision to go to that magnet high school, it was reinforced when, in high school, my cousin went to BUDS. And he became a Navy SEAL. And I said, well, I'm on the right path. And then, you know, applied to the Naval Academy, got accepted. Now, became a Navy SEAL. In retrospect, going to the Naval Academy, being an officer in the SEAL teams, statistically, that's probably, you know, the least likely way to become a SEAL. Right. But you don't know what you don't know. So yeah. It worked for my cousin. And it worked for me.
Yeah, that's awesome. And basically, you struck a process that I think young Americans today really need to take heed to is, if you have a passion and you know that passion, if you're lucky enough to know what you're really convicted to do at an early age, you got to plan it out and you got to go in, you know, into the deep end and not hold back. And you might be prepping 8th, 9th, 10th grade like you did, right? Like getting the education, boning up on that STEM program and all of that. Yep. And chasing that dream, it's not something you can choose overnight and get off to the races. By then we could be worth the back of the pack. And it's a testament to where you become, you know, what you developed in your military career. Now later, the stuff we're going to talk about, man, but it is a, you know, having a lot of SEAL team buddies mutually that we have, that is not the normal way I hear a guy's getting into the teams. So it's a great process.
Yeah. And there's something there's something different in your philosophy that I haven't heard before, Jared, that I'd like to put out. Something you're good at. So a lot of people aspire to be something that they're not very good at. And to be honest with you, they can't achieve it. And it's that reality check, like something you're good at, then you put a plan together. But, you know, you can do anything you want to do in this country, for sure. But you know what? Mm-hmm. You got to be good at it. You gotta say, hey, you know, I can think of lots of things. My wife's a very intelligent woman. She has a doctorate in pharmacy and everything. And there's a lot of things she's not good at. She just became a certified scuba diver, so I'm pretty excited about that. So
you're really good at that.
I was wondering, and she pulled that off, and I was pretty happy about that. So, but anyways, but I think that's part of a philosophy that people forget to throw at that. And usually something you're good at, you like, so you gravitate to that. So that's an easy sell, but it's something, you know, I'm dealing with a lot of college kids coming into it just out of high school, and they have these high aspirations, and then I see what they're good at. And, you know, I don't tell them that you should be looking somewhere else, but they really should. And I try to steer them towards other things and other paths, maybe along that line, but something they're good at. So thanks so much for bringing that out.
Well, I think that the more you can align doing something you enjoy with something you're good at, with something that someone will pay you to do, that is literally that's the
perfect combination.
That's the secret sauce, right there. And to clarify, when I say you have to be good at something, that doesn't mean you have to be the best. That doesn't mean that you have to be on varsity. That just means that you have some natural ability to perform a task.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, maybe the best example would be me and technology. Okay? Like, I know that I should like not do any, like I keep the IT department in business. Like, I am their job security. So, you know, and a lot of it, you know, this is kind of funny, but, you know, my attitude a lot of the time is, if it's broke, well, you hit it, right? that's not the approach that you should take when your computer's acting up. And by the way, you know, that's why I was about 10 minutes late to this, is because, you know, I have a new computer and I had to work some bugs out. So
that's too funny.
But, you know, but at the same time, to my credit, I'll brag on myself a little bit. You know, I'm 41 years old. I married a girl that is almost 10 years younger than me. And let me tell you, she's a whiz on the computer. So we just really balance things out, you know.
Yeah, there's a good team right there on all levels.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, great.
So Jay, when you made the choice, you started the teams, you got into Buds. I mean, everybody knows how tough Buds is. It's kind of legendary. Tell us a little bit about your experience in Buds and then deployment. When you got overseas to the Middle East, when we were red hot in the GWAT, in the Global War on Terror, you guys were really effective over there, but you lost a lot of brothers too. And you had some horrendously challenging deployments. They're just intense. Tell us about that if you could.
Sure. So, and let me back up to the Naval Academy. So I graduated, actually high school, graduated high school in 99, and I went to prep school. So the Naval Academy said, you know, we like you, we like your credentials, but you got to get that SAT up. So I went to prep school. I went to New Mexico Military Institute in Roswell, New Mexico, same place that Roger Staubach went to before, you know, basically his red shirt year. So now it's 2000 when I finished up prep school and I go to the Naval Academy. Well, you know, we were a nation at peace. There was nothing going on.
Right.
And then my sophomore year, Twin Towers come down.
Wow.
And so that you could, it was just a different reality, because at that point we weren't training to enter a military during a peaceful time. We were going to war, and that reality set in when I was a midshipman. So, you know, finished up the Naval Academy, graduated in 2004, and did not initially get selected for BUDS, SEAL selection. I was not one of the 16 or so guys, all guys from my Naval Academy class. So I had to take the detour, and I picked a warship that was deploying out of San Diego. I wanted to deploy right away so that I could start working on my qualifications, because the way that the Navy set up is I would not be able to apply for a lateral transfer into the Naval Special Warfare Community until I first was surface warfare qualified. Okay. So the way that you become surface warfare qualified is, yeah, I mean, you've just got to deploy. And you start working on those qualifications. So I think the fleet average to get your SWO pin, your service warfare officer pin, I think the fleet average, at least at the time, was 22 months. I was motivated. I got my SWO pin in less than a year.
Nice.
And wow. And then dropped my package to go to BUDS, knowing, you know, at this point it's 2005, knowing full well that, you know, we're going down range. This is, you know, kinetic operations, and dropped my package, and BUDS was man, it was everything. It was every bit of misery and cold and suck that you can possibly imagine, and then some. And while it was cold, wet, miserable, it was awesome. It was just, it was fun. And I think that you just have to have that to get through the program. This is a program with 80% attrition. And, you know, to get through that program, I don't know. I think you have to look at things differently. You have a different sense of humor. You know, at the end of the day, what made BUDS great were the people to your left and right. you know, after Hell Week, after, you know, the people that were left standing. That's what made Buds awesome. That high caliber person that I was fortunate to be able to work with.
Oh, very impressive. And you say things that I like to peel the onion on because I don't hear a lot. The prep school part, you talk about being good at something, but you went to a prep school so you could achieve your goals. So they polished you up. They honed you. That was a process that honed you to get to that next step, huh, Jared?
Sure. Yeah. Here's the thing. If you aim high enough, you'll be challenged. If you aim high enough, you know, that if you pick the biggest mountain out there to climb, you're going to be challenged, right? And so, I mean, that is the Naval Academy, right?
Yeah.
It's, I don't know, 10-12% acceptance rate. You're dealing with very intelligent people that go to that school. And, you know, I picked the Mount Everest of colleges to go to. And, and they said, you know what? You get that SAT score up a little bit more. I took the SAT, I want to say like 12 times. Really? There's no quit. There's no quitting.
I love to hear that, actually. Yeah. That's something that I want to go back to, because I want to have listeners, you know, when they go to be game wardens, whenever they achieve their goals, there's ways to hone your skills to get there. And there's nothing wrong. I became good at taking game warden tests. I probably took 20 before I got the job. I just became good at that. But you're absolutely right. Yeah. And those are things in your character that I think everybody can use and take home and say, hey, because sometimes we think the kid that needs a little extra help to achieve those goals, we're like, yeah, look at that kid, you know, but no, look at that kid. You know, he knows what he wants to do. He knows how to hone his skills. And now he's doing that. I mean, even physically, you know, to go to a trainer, they're professionals to get you in that shape to achieve your goals, no matter what they are. So I'm listening to this, and there's little things that I want to focus on that I think can help a lot of our younger listeners to achieve their goals in the future. And, you know, you're very successful, so that's pretty awesome. So thank you for bringing out something I thought, you know, you probably thought was insignificant and little, and I'm like, that's huge to a younger listener that, you know, feels, you know, I can think of several that have reached out to John and I in the process, you know, and they feel like that they've done it six times and, you know, that what am I doing wrong? And I like that because we can help them hone their skills. But in the same part, you know, they need to hone their skills. There needs to be that process. You need to get better at what you're doing. So thanks for sharing.
Yeah, well, I'll for the young kids, I will take work ethic over talent every day of the week.
Absolutely.
I mean, work ethic, with a strong work ethic, you can overcome so much that talent alone won't even get you into the front door.
Yeah. Yeah, that's spot on. But, you know, the other thing too, to kind of pony on what Wayne just said, is this ability to want and need to rely on other teams, right? I mean, we all come from really dedicated teams, and we'll all talk, you know, especially you with the SEAL teams, starting out where you went late for your professional life. Now we're in technology, kids are isolated, they're working alone, you know, the idea of reaching out to another professional to give them advice and have a thick enough skin to say, I want to be a sponge. We just don't see a lot of that. And, you know, that's getting to your work ethic and your motivation to no quit that we share, but saying, okay, I'm going to figure this out on the internet and I don't want to ask for help because I just want to stay in my bubble. And that's, I mean, you're already a step behind, right? That's a failure type of attitude because you just don't have that in mind. And we're just seeing more and more of that because there's just less teams being built, you know, for our youth, unfortunately. And I think it's a huge message that has to come back. But everything you did there in the Navy, going through Buds, and now you're ramping up to deploy. Tell us a little bit about, you know, when you were over there, how many tours, and really what your biggest challenges were and what you saw that resonated.
Yeah. Let's see, I did the initial deployments as a surface warfare officer, floated around the Northern Arabian Gulf. And then, I had the opportunity after Buds to augment, SEAL Team 6. So I in essence deployed with them for about 60 days. I came back and then a few weeks later deployed for 7 months with SEAL Team 1. And then my last deployment, if you will, for the military folks, it was technically not a deployment. It was a PCS. And I took a staff job at Unit 3 in the island kingdom of Bahrain. And I learned in that staff job that I just wasn't cut out to be a staff officer.
Right.
There was definitely for me an element of probably survivor's guilt. And you're forward, you're in Bahrain, and you know, for the most part, you are coordinating training with host nation allies. But there was some support things that we would do for kinetic operations, and you know, you're forwards and you're there, but you're not really there, and in tandem with some survivor's guilt. So I didn't really like being a staff officer, and that's when I decided to leave the Navy. You know, I'll say this in general about being a SEAL officer, which any combat leader, your job, you know, if you want to distill it in the most basic of ways, as a combat leader, whether it's military, law enforcement, whatever, you're a manager of violence.
Right.
And you're choosing, you know, taking and saving lives. And that's what it is. The most humbling part of the job for me, and I think a lot of people would agree with me, is so you're in charge and you're managing people that are better than you, people that are faster, stronger, smarter, people that are subject matter experts. You know, as an officer, you're not an SME of anything. You're not a sniper. You're not a breacher. You're not a medic. You're not a comms guy. And so you're dealing with these people that, you know, that have this just incredibly extensive knowledge of the craft that they specialize in. And so literally you're a jack of all trades, expert in none. And so as a combat leader, it's your job to, you know, just understand holistically what the battlefield looks like, and to place those assets, and your greatest asset is your people, to place those people in the position to get the job done the most effective way. And so you're just, you know, you're dealing with people, you're leading people that are better than you. And that is humbling. The other part to that, and what I've learned through the process, is it's great to be a part of a team that otherwise, you know, you're doing something that no individual can do. You know, and I think that, you know, what the essence of teamwork is, I think it's lost on a lot of people. Because there's no selfishness in it.
Right.
You've got to be altruistic. You got to put other people ahead of you. You got to put the mission ahead of maybe what you individually want to do. But it's amazing when you see it come together. It's like watching water run downhill. It's just seamless. It's just smooth. It's just fluid. And it's a really great thing to have experienced.
Yeah, to reiterate that, I know that feeling, and I know from being a MET lieutenant and forming up the team that you're very familiar with, and that you know the guys now. It is beyond a privilege to work with a group of one percenters and be there for them and let them do what they do best. It's a dance, you know. It's like a perfect choreographed dance of water flowing down the hill. It's right as rain, right? To just coin a couple of phrases, and it's very humbling. It's a burden on your shoulders that we embrace, because we want to be there and we want to look out and make sure they have everything they can do to be effective, and just we share in their glory. It's amazing. So yeah, I feel you in that way. And again, getting back to kids and understanding what teams are, like a Super Bowl caliber team or a Pac-10 caliber football team, same type of thing. You know, when you're coordinating that type of deal, maybe the consequences aren't as severe, of course, with what we were dealing with, but that's a great way to say it. Appreciate that. And I got to, so when you came out of the military, I got to share a story. Well,
I think. Oh boy, which one?
You wanted to help us out on the Met front.
Yeah.
You wanted to help us out. You had come out of the military. You were looking for, you know, where you were going to go next professionally and what type of team you were going to build. We met through our mutual friend, Blake. We started hunting together. You actually went to your first hunter safety class, I think, the ranch that we did up through Blake's family. And you were one committed to conservation, wanted to start hunting, which, me being a game warden, a fellow hunter, love that. Then we meet, and then you're saying, well, what is this Met team? What's this cartel cannabis poisoning the environment. You know, you guys are getting in gunfights in the Silicon Valley with these embedded cartel operatives. How can I help in that fight? You didn't want to get out of the fight. So you actually, for our listeners, I think they'll enjoy this story. You started a reserve deputies academy to embed with the sheriff's office of Santa Clara County because we on the Fish and Game front didn't have a reserve program yet. But we really wanted to work with you, of course, you know, given your SEAL team background, your combat experience, and great level head. So everybody, my partners on the sheriff's office, after I breached that idea, they were like, heck yeah, let's get them involved. And now you went to a different kind of academy that was the absolute polar opposite of the challenges of BUDS. And that was a heck of a sacrifice you made. Can you tell us some stories about what you experienced in that academy and what type of other candidates you were integrating with? Let's just say that.
So it's an indoctrination, as you would expect of any law enforcement or military organization. They're going to break you down
right
to zero, and then they're going to build you back up. My experience was unique compared to most, you know, possibly all of my classmates, because I had already been through the most grueling indoctrination that you can think of.
Right.
And I know the process and I know the purpose, and you just got to do it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So did it have the same effect on me as other people? It is necessary, but no, it didn't have the same effect on me because I've been there. I've done that.
Yeah.
And you know, so, you know, I fond memories, you know, and helping people out that maybe don't see the bigger picture, you know, things like that. But, even in that kind of indoctrination, program, you still, it's about the people. Yeah. We still had fun, you know, and, you know, you find humor in things that maybe other people wouldn't find humor in, but it's indoctrination. It sucks. There's no way around it. So you find humor where you can. But at the same time, it's about the person to your left and right.
Yeah.
That's what makes it worth it.
Yeah. That was just, I think it was just a big sacrifice on your part to come back through a basic reserve academy, just coming stateside, you know.
I'm not going to say it wasn't painful.
Yeah, we can understand that. But that was huge that you did that and that you took notice of what was going on domestically. You were fighting a global war on terror with your brothers on the military side. Well, we're fighting a domestic eco-terrorism war within borders that, as you know, still goes on. And we're still working together on that through our Triumph Outreach and everything I do with you. Mm-hmm. But there's not too many guys that would do that coming out of that level of combat and that level of experience and dive right back in. And it was just a real testament to you, brother, to acknowledge that on the conservation environmental front and public safety front and say, hey, I want to stay involved. You know, I want to be on the ground a little bit. And I applaud you for that. Thank you.
Well, it was an experience for me, a learning experience for me, because at the time I didn't know that literally we were at war in Central and Northern California against the cartels. I didn't know what reclamation was
right
before we met.
Yeah,
I did not know the devastating effects that are the result of these illegal grow sites. And when you understand that, it becomes a lot easier to go through, you know, another indoctrination so that you can go and become deputized and so that you can help, you know, at the end of the day, I've got lessons learned. I want to share those with other people so that the mission can be accomplished faster. And, you know, the reclamation mission is super, super important and probably not talked about enough.
Yeah. Yeah. And I appreciate you helping on that front too. And a lot of guys in special forces, as you know, a lot of mutual colleagues of ours have taken notice to it in the stuff we've talked about over the last couple of years. And everybody resonates on the patriotic front, whether you're a military special operations veteran, you're a special operations domestic first responder, you're a conservationist, a hunter, an angler, a game warden, a park ranger, whatever. Mm-hmm. And now it's a national fight, and you've done a lot of that with the business too, moving forward. But yep. Before we jump into that, let's talk about after you took that first hunter education class, got your official hunter safety card, started hunting, and it wasn't long after that we had that elk hunt, your first mm-hmm. big game, successful big game harvest, because I know we didn't share that together. We had had a hunt. We were unsuccessful. Yep. We had a great hunt. Take us through that moment, because that first moment, it's just magical. You know,
the first thing that jumps out to me is, keep in mind, this was a transition for me from hunting critters with two legs to four hooves.
For sure.
But the hunt is about the camaraderie. The hunt is about the storytelling. The hunt is about the adventure, regardless of if you harvest or not. But like you said, I did not harvest. I think maybe a quarter of the people on that week long or so hunt harvested, correct? I remember about a quarter of the guys.
Yeah, I think while I was there with you on that elk hunt, we had Mike, who's that trout angler, the trout guide.
Okay.
Nice Mike Folden. He got that one nice bull we all kind of converged on in different groups.
Yeah.
Before I had to leave the woods. And I think you might have got one other elk out of 10 hunters. So yeah, it was less than 20%.
Yeah, 20%, something like that.
Yeah.
What a great way to for that experience in the Bob Marshall going in, and filling, exfilling by horseback.
Right.
And the shelter's already set up and you've got the wood burning stove. That's the only bad thing about that being your first hunt is it's like they're not all that nice.
Goes downhill from there.
Spoils, yeah.
But guys like us, we like misery. So it's not beyond us to we'll have a good time when we're cold and wet and shivering, and that's typically what hunting is. So that was a great first time hunt. So let me think. My first harvest, I think it was Montana black bear.
Yeah, I think it was, right?
I'm pretty sure it was Montana black bear with Jana Waller.
Jana, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So then, I went probably a year or so after that, I went to Idaho and I got another black bear. And there's a misconception that bear doesn't taste good. Bear, it's all about the preparation. Absolutely. Bear's awesome.
It's delicious.
So good.
Yeah.
Most recently, this is awesome. I had the hunt of a lifetime. I drew a Shiris moose tag and harvested in Idaho.
Oh, that was a great hunt. Yeah, I know that, man. Wow.
Yeah, that was about a year ago, a little bit more than a year ago. Mm-hmm. And that was magical. It was magical. And you never, when you go out to a hunt, especially when, from middle America out to Idaho, a lot of preparation goes into that.
Yeah.
And you never know how it's going to end. This one was so fast. I show up, I confirm my optic is good to go. The next morning, we embark on the trails by ATV, and we'd been out there for about 2 hours.
Yeah.
And I'm hunting out there with a retired Marine. Perfect. and we identify some moose. Don't know how many are in there, but I love working with this guy. His name's Mike. Because we just real quick, within a couple minutes, came up with a hasty plan, and this is his backyard, right? So he's in charge, and he's basically kind of like my guide, right? And so he's calling this big old moose. We know it's a male because you can hear literally its antlers, rubbing up on that tree. And so he's like, "I want you to run around the bowl. You see that tree right over there? Like, yep. I want you to pop out, just pop out right there and you'll get a look." And so I ran around the bowl, 150, 200 yards, whatever it was. I popped out right where he said, and those moose, it was two cows and a bull. They were curious. They're like, "What is that?" And as soon as I popped out through the timber and showed myself, they were all running. And I just sat down, or I didn't sit down. I just breathed out, found that bull. Pop, and he was on the go. It was it was inside of 150 yards.
Yeah,
but it was in a moose, even a Shiris moose, which they're the smallest of the moose family. Massive,
yeah.
Majestic.
Awesome.
So like to look at how big they are and to see how delicate they can run and maneuver those thick woods. I mean, it's magical. And so did not have much time at all on this shot and just breathed out and, you know, go back to basics and nice low trigger squeeze and dropped them right there. And awesome. And that was it. But that was a lot of fun. And man, I hope my wife lets me go on another hunt like that.
Oh, man.
But, you know, we got the 1 month old. So that might be a year or two out.
We'll make one happen when the kids are the right age, right? Yeah.
Yep.
We'll get back.
Yeah. My son, he's 20 months old now, and I can't wait.
Yeah.
It's gonna be fun to teach him some stuff. To take him out, make stories.
Yeah, absolutely magical, man. And I remember when you called me about that hunt, and you were so excited. And we talked ballistics, and we were getting rifle because we both have the same rifle. That
bolt seven mag, yeah.
Yeah, you got that seven mag. And we're, you know, I was all the way in Montana at the time, and I wanted to get on the range together, but we couldn't do that. So we used a little bit of technology. We used FaceTime and we talked ballistics, and you were shooting trying all kinds of different ammo and getting your dope down and doing some moving shots. And again, to what you said in the beginning of our conversation today, it was almost like you were going back to deployment because of this. You knew how special this hunt was. And now it's like, I'm going to prepare. And you prepared for months.
I did. Yeah.
Getting your ballistics down, getting the right load, getting really proficient back on a bolt gun outside of a carbine.
Yep.
Kudos to you. And I was, I felt very lucky to live that hunt vicariously through you as I was getting updates in real time from the training to the prep to the travel and then the pictures. And I was up on another hunt and unfortunately couldn't join you on that one. And I was just elated for you, brother. That was a big, big success after so much preparation and moose meat.
You know what? I had honestly, I had forgotten all the prep.
Yeah,
you know,
I remember.
But
well.
You're right. We talked for hours.
Yep.
You know, broken up over weeks and months. Nice. We talked for hours.
Yeah.
And you know, some people may not understand, but when you pulled Shiras moose in Idaho. That is a literally once in a lifetime.
Yeah.
And you prepare for it.
Yeah.
Because that's it. It ain't going to happen again.
Yeah. And I love that it was one of those hunts that unlike all the other hunts we've been on, most of us, Wayne, you, myself, how often does that happen? Like the first dang day you're out there, it's a lifetime hunt. It's happened one time for me on a mountain goat and that's it. Yeah. Never. And when it happened for you, man, I was just tickled because you had done so much good prep on it. And and then I remember we talked shortly after, and I think you actually did a social media post on this because it was worthy of that, but a couple inside texts on how good moose meat is.
Mm.
And talk about that. I mean, because not a lot of people, you know, that have had the opportunity to taste moose along with elk and deer and everything else. It's just an amazing meat, you know?
Oh, yeah. It's... So one of the coolest parts about the harvest was being able to share the meat, share the harvest with several friends that I shipped, you know, on dry ice. I shipped coolers to several different friends, but also I shipped a cooler of, and it was the steak and it was the roast and it was ground moose. It was a nice variety. I shipped over to the C4 Ranch, which is the Charlie Keating charity. So they're in Southern California, and it's a place where veterans can go and decompress and work on mental health and stuff like that. So I was able to ship a cooler out to Chuck's dad and for those guys and girls that go down there to enjoy it. You know, the moose steak, once you have moose steak, you're just kind of disappointed.
Yeah.
With, right?
Yeah.
it's kind of like, you know, that first hunt on horseback, Bob Marshall, the tent set up, like you got the guides, you know, and then no hunt is ever going to be that, what's the right word? Just like everything was done for you, right?
Yeah. Gentleman's hunt.
Same concept. Yeah. You have that moose steak and well, beef is not as good as it used to be. I'll just say that.
Amen to that.
It changes you. Yeah. I've still got little bit of some ground moose left. So that'll be a great addition for, it's winter now, and that'll be a great addition for my winter chili. Nice.
There you go. Yeah. Nice. Savoring every last piece of that amazing blessing of that moose. Yeah. That's great.
Thanks for sharing that moose story, Jerry, because you got me excited. And when you talk about that, you can hear the passion in your voice. And I hope our listeners were on the edge of their seats just like I was, because, I was right there with you. And, you know, to talk about how good it tastes and things like that. You know, as a game warden, I guess I never really, you know, moose were a lot of them when I started my career. I started getting roadkill as my father would go out and get a roadkill moose like once a year. So I've been eating moose a long time. Yep. Now the tick infestation has come and our moose population has plummeted compared to what we were. So now I am where we used to get, you know, 50, 60 collisions a year easily. In my area now, we're down to maybe two or three.
Really? Wow. Yeah. That's
I used to sign on my day, and it was where I was going to pick up the dead moose. That's how I started my day as a game warden 20 years ago. It was just, there was a dead moose somewhere hit by a car, and that's how I started my day. Where am I going to go pick up the dead moose? And now, if they get three a year, it's a miracle. So, and even becomes more desired is that meat, because we used to have a roadkill list that people could get it, but now it's even more desired. It's that it's just like you were talking about. And moose have
so now where you are, what kind of, so there's three kind of moose, right? There's Cyrus,
Alaskan,
Yukon, and then Alaskan.
Yes.
Or is Yukon and Alaskan the same?
The same subspecies.
So there's three kind of moose, right?
Mm-hmm. You're right.
And so which kinds of moose is out by you?
It would
be
the
Cyrus, or is it
the Canada moose or the East Coast side?
Okay, gotcha.
So and Maine has quite a few, New Hampshire, Vermont, New York a little, and then you get up into those Canadian provinces above us, you know, New Brunswick, Newfoundland is probably got the highest population on the eastern side of, you know, North America.
It's where my brother-in-law went, and you know, well, so a couple things. This is the Cyrus moose that I shot in Idaho. It has started a. I'm going to get all three. Is where I'm going with this. Awesome. I got to get all three.
You're going slam route now. And, you're hooked, man.
I'm hooked 100%. But yeah, my brother-in-law, he went out to Newfoundland and he said, you know, the moose are so plentiful there. It was like, all right, pick the one that you want, you know?
Mm.
So yes. it was a different kind of hunt.
Yeah.
Cause the Cyrus moose hunt that I did, like they're not everywhere. I mean, I got lucky.
Yes.
I got really, really lucky to harvest on my first full day. Nice. I don't think that I was out there for a week plus. I don't think I saw a single other moose that whole time.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you work for it. And there was definitely an element of luck.
Yeah. And the work is after you pull the trigger too. I mean, to butcher a moose.
Packing those things out.
Yes. Oh. Yeah. That's.
Oh yeah.
that's when the whole work of it, and that's when you will really appreciate it, when you're sitting down and having that moose steak that you put so much work, so much effort, so much planning into that, that it becomes a part of you and a part of, your story was just awesome. I was like, that's just great to hear the excitement that still lives on. I you know, like everybody tells their hunting stories and we get fired up, and it's not just about pulling the trigger. It's about the prep.
No.
It's about the harvest. It's about getting the animal out. I mean, I dragged a deer out in the dark this year. I forgot how that was. That's miserable. You know, running into blowdowns that you never saw. So that's part of my story, and I got scrapes and bruises to prove it.
The pack out. It makes that meat, whatever it is, even better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
Oh yeah.
Excellent. Yeah, well, thanks for sharing.
Man. I have yet to try a moose steak. Not having harvested one yet. So hopefully we're going to make that happen, bro.
Yeah.
I like that. I like how that sounds.
Somewhere, somehow, that sounds awesome. But, that kind of segues into all the good hunting talk we're talking about and our Second Amendment rights right now. And what's going on in this country related to conservation, self-protection, everything else. And one of the reasons why you started, and you got the great shirt with our emblem on it, Triumph Systems, which I'm fortunate to be a part of, and a reactive target company that actually brings in conservation targets as well as anything else you would need for defensive, proactive pistol and rifle training. Tell us about Triumph and how it started as we dive into some of those 2A issues.
Sure. Where to start? I mean, right. There's so much going on. So two years ago, at the height of the riots, that was kind of a, for me, it was so close to home because we've moved since then, but the building that our warehouse was in was under siege. It was attacked. All of the retail stores were looted, were burned. Now, we barricaded our warehouse and our inventory ended up being fine. And we've since moved to outside of the city.
Right.
It's so evident today in the day and age that we live that, there was a defund the police movement. And I think that a lot of the cities that moved in that direction, they're backpedaling at this point.
Oh yeah.
And it's they're realizing it. This is not defund the police. The conversation should be, let's fund better training, period. Mm-hmm. So I'll back up before the riots, before COVID and the riots and whatnot. I left active duty. I stayed in the military industrial complex for 3 years or so. I did that TV show on National Geographic Channel. Yep. Post-military working in the industry, I saw an opportunity to really innovate how people train with firearms, not only train, but just experience the range. Cause we kind of talked about it earlier. If you enjoy doing something, you're going to do it more. Right. So, if I can make target shooting more fun, well, that's a good thing because people are going to spend more time on the range. So, started Triumph Systems and, really we have a pretty diverse and wide product offering. Internally, we say we have our retail SKUs and then we have our government products. And they range from, fun targets that ooze, that you can visually see when you shoot them, to targets that kind of splatter when you shoot them too. And that's our retail products. And then the other spectrum is our government products. And really that is a mobile turning target system that literally it has a motor, it has a remote, and it flips from a threat to a no threat. Because we have to be thinking shooters. If you are in a profession that requires you to wear a firearm, you've got to be prepared in stressful situations to make the right decision. So, my thought process is if you're just training on static targets to shoot a bullseye, but you carry a gun for a living, that's probably not the right type of training. So just saw an opportunity to innovate how law enforcement, how military trains, saw an opportunity to make target shooting more fun for your recreational shooters or hunters or whatnot. And, definitely we've made a big difference.
Yeah. It's been an incredible system of targets. And being fortunate to be one of your pro staffers from the start of this thing, given what the stuff we've done in the past from a conservation law enforcement standpoint, from a game wardens conservation and hunter education, and then also on the tactical side, I just like using all of our targets for all the classes and all the mentoring I do. We have the ethical harvest target that's a white-tailed deer, a buck that's got the vitals with the red and the blue oozers to get, immediate visual feedback. It's a great target for teaching new hunters, It really, really is. And then, of all the different classes we do either on the government law enforcement, military side or civilian classes, if I didn't know you and I wasn't part of the company, so to speak, I would pick these things up and go, hey, that's going to be a really fun target for first time women shooters. I just had three ladies do a first time intro to pistol class last weekend up here on my West Coast training facility. And we did an evil clown at the end of the day. And
nice.
all of them got to shoot the evil clown multiple reps, working their Glocks and doing combat reloads and good stance. They were giggling, they were laughing, they were doing fundamentals, and they were hitting lights out.
Nice.
And these ladies never shot a handgun before tactically. Maybe they shot a 22 as a kid. And they wanted, hey, can we get pictures with the evil clown? Evil clowns aren't going to be allowed during our holidays, blah, blah, blah. And that's what this whole thing brings, man. So it's really cool to be a part of it, but it's also cool to see the evolution and the progress Triumph is making, especially with the Pivotal Trainer. You mentioned threat, no threat target. And I want to just talk that up with you a little bit, because that's the one thing, you know, I use internally with my old Met colleagues, other agencies, including Met, they still have that system and use it. We've used it on several shooting related TV shows to show that stress. And I've had fellow hosts from other tier one shooting related television shows run them through a Pivotal Trainer drill. Mm-hmm. And these guys have shot forever. They've been through every type of reactive stress scenario you can imagine. And they're going, wow, man, my heart is racing. You know, when I'm doing that lateral step, and am I going to see, you know, the cell phone? Am I going to see the pistol? What other threats coming at me? And it's just, it's a great, great target system. And I know we have some new developments we're going to show at SHOT this year of some other improvements that are going to be good, but love the products, and everyone seems to be resonating with them well. And the origin, I think, of why you started the company and filling that gap and that need, especially in the crazy times we're in now, like you said, the defund the police, the people are turning back on that. And just our citizenry throughout the U.S., even traditional, Wayne and I have talked about on several previous podcasts, especially on Thin Green Line, we started this second podcast right through COVID because everybody wanted to learn and they wanted to hear about preparedness, self-reliance. And I think, what was it, Wayne? Sometime between March and April of last year, when we started those first couple episodes, Jared, we were seeing a 30 to 40% increase in traditional non-gun users, non-hunters, going to online states that they live in to get hunter safety certifications. Go and try to buy their first firearms to try to learn, hey man, if I have to harvest an animal to survive, if this pandemic goes any further where we're completely off the grid now and cut off, I kind of feel like I'm at a disadvantage and I'm playing catch up. So we had in a horrible national situation, well, worldwide situation, we suddenly had this, you know, we played to the positives. We had traditional non-shooters, non-conservationists suddenly seeing the light and saying, hey, I want to try that without pressure. Now it's survival. And that's where these targets come into play. And that's where you know, we start to get people into the right mindset and make it fun and not evil and not intimidating. But there's a push for it now. And I'm really glad in the country, you know, that there is, for all the right reasons.
Yeah.
How about the lack of ammo, Jared? Does that hurt you?
You know, no, I'll say no, it hasn't. But I think that it's been cause for people to reevaluate kind of how they train, and which results in training as a function just being it's more valuable than it was before, because there are supply shortages. So it's like, okay, when you go out there and train, it better be worth it. It better be the best damn training that we can create, because this once abundant resource is no longer. So I wouldn't say that it's affected us, and it hadn't affected the government. The government, you know, they've got the federal government, the state governments, they've got stuff. Some of the local smaller departments, I think it's just made people realize, hey, when we dedicate the resources to train, it better be the best damn training we can do.
Yep.
And that's excellent. That's literally what we do. We facilitate awesome training. And, you know, John, you mentioned SHOT. We'll be out there on our turning target system, the Pivotal Trainer. The number one feedback item that I hear from end users is, can I customize this so that I can just, you know, hit a button and then it's going to flip, you know, to do the qualification shoot the way I want it to. I just want to hit go, and then it's going to have a memory, and it's going to do the course of fire that I set up. Well, prior to now, we've not had that capability, but at SHOT Show, we'll be launching a smart version of the Pivotal Trainer that has that feature to it. Nice. So we're excited, and I can't wait to see you guys at SHOT. It's going to be, you know, just long overdue. We didn't have shot last year.
We didn't. And the last shot show we had the previous year was a really good one for us at Triumph. And it was just, the world was in a better place. I think that was one of the best shots, well, definitely the best one I've been to, with all the sponsors and everybody kind of coming together. And it's kind of like an old homecoming week and a reunion just to get back and
see it really is.
Face and be around our products.
Are so excited to have you in our booth.
Can't wait.
Again this year. Sign in. I don't know how many books we bought, but we'll sign some books and get them out to the first 25 or 50 people or however many it is.
Yeah, we'll bring some fun awareness around all that, man, and I appreciate it. It's just going to be good to see you again and
just
generate some good message. I appreciate it.
Yep.
And that's a mega step for you guys. I mean, that's awesome. Hit go and it does the whole scenario. I mean, rather than the guy sitting there pushing it every time and has to remember, oh my goodness, you just took that such to the next level for training. That's incredible.
Yeah. Well, so it does a couple things. One, if you're the RS, if you're the head trainer, you're not messing around with the remote control. You hit go and you're watching the students. So that's the first thing. The second thing is it allows for you to train to objective standards. Because when you're manually controlling a turning target system, it might, for student A, it might flip and expose a threat for 3 seconds. And then, you put the next person through it and it might be 5 seconds, right? Mm. So you cannot train to an objective standard under those conditions. But now that, we've got this memory and this ability to program it, it's the same for everybody. Yeah. And I can score you objectively. So, there's that element as well.
Game changer.
It is a game changer. Yep.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing ahead of the SHOT Show. People can go see it.
I'm excited. We are excited.
We got to release this before SHOT Show, John, so we get the cutting edge of Triumph.
We're dropping this week, right?
Well, whenever you say go, we go.
It's going to be a Christmas week edition.
Yeah, this could be a Christmas week or it could be a very early January, right? Yeah. Before we go to SHOT. For sure.
Okay.
Awesome.
Very cool.
Liking it.
And Jared, got to ask, we've had some conversations, obviously, off podcast, but around the training we're doing and what we're trying to generate and provide on the Triumph side, just where the state of the country is right now in general, massive political polarization, a lot of civil unrest, a lot of targeting against our Second Amendment gun rights for all the wrong reasons. What do you think are some of the things we need to be aware of, or our American public needs to be aware of moving forward to correct the problems, to align us right, and not to favor anyone's side, but just to bring us together more as a country, lessen the polarization, agree to disagree, but do something that's going to protect our country from all the attacks we're having internally and externally, and continue along the mantra of conservation, legitimate Second Amendment rights, safe gun handling, and just an American public that is prepared for anything that can come down the gate, especially in lieu of COVID.
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is there's a lot of actors out there, whether it's institutional or individuals, that it seems like their focus is to pit people against each other.
Yeah.
And, and we have all of this, choice in terms of where we get our media and who we want to listen to. And unfortunately, a lot of people, they're going to tune in to those channels that reinforce whatever their thought is. And it just lends itself to a population that is not open-minded, that doesn't want to talk. And so I think that, that's a great place to start, is realizing that, you know what? We have a lot more in common than these people will ever admit to. So let's have an open conversation and figure out what's our common ground. And then, we can figure out the next best step for whatever the problem, whatever the discussion is. But we actually have a lot more in common than these people want us to think. So that honestly is where I would start. And you can do that as an individual this holiday season. when you go home to see your family.
Yeah.
That if it's like any family that I know of, not everybody is in alignment. And it's really easy to just want to believe what you believe and not listen to someone else's perspective. But, you can start now. You can start this holiday season. So that's a great place where everybody can have impact. I think that the past 2 years have really highlighted the fact that the individual is responsible for his or her safety first. We don't want to live in a police state where there's a cop at every single corner. I don't want to outsource protection. I don't want to outsource family defense or family protection to the government. So I am the first line of defense for me. I am the first line of defense for my family. And, we talked about the defund the police movement and that pendulum, even in the bigger cities swinging back. I think that the past 18 months, people are realizing that, they want to be responsible for their own safety, because we've just seen systematic failures with between the riots and some of the political movements of defunding the police and taking training away and not giving those guys what they need. It's scary. And even people that were anti-gun, didn't want anything to do with it, I can't tell you how many of those people I know that call me, "Hey, I bought this gun. Will you come and train me how to use it?" And they were the biggest anti-gun people, but it is scary. So that's the other part, is people realize that this is a scary world, and you are truly responsible for protecting those things that money and insurance cannot replace. I'm talking about your life. I'm talking about your safety and that of your spouse and kids, your family.
No doubt.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that statement. Well said. And I think because we're running scared as a society right now with what's happening and what we don't know is going to happen in the future, that's the start of bringing us together. There's more common ground even in that. And like, I get the same thing from countless people. "Hey, I can't get ammo anywhere. Can you help me get ammo? Can you do a training for me?" And very much anti-gun up to a point. Looked at us as kind of like an aggressive type of mantra mentality, those of us on the Conservation 2A front. And now it's like, well, wait a minute. They're opening their minds. I'm taking, I'm lowering my guard. And we're bonding as Americans over this realization. And I think it's great for the country. I think we need it yesterday. And we need more of it now, and more of what you said to a perfect point. Just be very wary of the media outlets you're watching and take things with a grain of salt and get face to face. Let's get off our devices and get off an Instagram and get off of a news channel and off of a bias left or right, no matter what your source is, and start to get face to face safely and just say, "Hey man, we can agree to disagree. Tell me more about you. What do you think is going on with this pandemic? What have you experienced that's been scary? Have you been personally threatened in any way outside of just fear of a virus?" And I've had so many bonding conversations with people over this that are anti-gun just by being empathetic and listening. And they end up, you, Wayne, myself, they end up really seeing, hey, we're not crazy gun-toting, quote unquote aggressors. We're just out here doing good stuff for the country, for preparedness and a little bit of American pride. And people need to look after one another and not be fearful now. Preparing for the worst, expecting the best, and living with less fear. And that's just what we need as a country. So absolutely spot on. And I know we all try to propagate that wherever we go in our worlds, the three of us and the people we work with. And I hope we get some results sooner than later.
Well, it's nothing stays the same.
Right.
So it's I'm glad that we're closing the books on 21, and I look forward to 22. I think it's going to be a great year.
Yeah,
onward and forward.
Onward and forward.
It is onward and forward. All to good stuff. And before we close out, how can our listeners and viewers follow you? What are your channels?
Awesome. So check out my company first and foremost, triumph-systems.com. And check out our awesome, if you love to shoot, come and check out our website. You can follow it. You can look up Triumph Systems on Facebook, Instagram. We're there, Twitter as well. Me personally, Jared W. Ogden, J-A-R-E-D-W, Ogden, O-G-D-E-N. So I'm on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter as well. So definitely, if you enjoyed the podcast, I know that the three of us have enjoyed it. So, come and give me a follow on Instagram or whatever. And we'll keep the conversation going.
Yeah, no.
Love it, man. Well, we can't thank you enough for being on the show. It's so good to see you virtually and to get together in person in a couple of weeks at that awesome SHOT Show. Finally.
I can't wait. And you're going to see some cool stuff at SHOT. And then we've had the backdoor conversations. There's stuff going on that I can't talk about right now. But maybe
too as well.
in 6 or 8 months.
Yeah, so. That sounds like another podcast, Jared, for sure. And I've got a whole page of notes that we kind of moved through.
Sweet.
I certainly wanted to follow up. And first and foremost, thank you for your service. And we appreciate you coming on. You've been a dynamic interview. Things that, I still want to peel back that onion, learn a little more about you and the things you're doing now. And the relationship with you and John is epic. So I think, good team.